Your Science Magazine of the Air presents another story from The Human Adventure.
The Mutual Broadcasting System and the University of Chicago present The Human Adventure.
And as your host, Mr. Walter Eust, editor of the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Today, the dramatic, amusing story of Shakespeare in America.
Once more into the breach, dear friends. Once more, our stacks the wall with our American dead. In peace, there's nothing so becomes a man as modest stillness and humility. But when the blast of war blows in our ears, then imitate the action of the tiger.
Good heavens, what's that?
That's Shakespeare.
But it can't be. That's the King from Henry V. It's English dead. Or close the wall up with our English dead.
Not in this case. Listen.
I see you stand like hound dogs in the brush, straining upon the start. The game's afoot. Honor your spirit, and upon this charge, cry God for Washington and the people's cause.
Cry God for Harry, England, and St. George.
That was in England. This isn't the story of Shakespeare in England. This is the story of Shakespeare in America.
Oh, I'm sorry I interrupted. But I suppose the story of Shakespeare in America starts with the Revolution, really.
Well, it starts before the Revolution. The story of Shakespeare in America is a story first of those first Englishmen who looked upon Shakespeare as a symbol of the arts of home. It is a story next of those American colonists who, even in rebellion, looked upon him as a link with a higher culture. And finally, it is the story of the gentle voyager who became a part of a new nation and a new speech and a new world.
Now your host on The Human Adventure, Mr. Walter Eust.
Vividly from the actual plays and widely from selected quotations from Shakespeare, Americans, as we shall see, learned ideals of sensitivity and behavior, of eloquence and conduct, as Professor Esther Cloudman Dunn of South Smith College shows in her book, Shakespeare in America. Shakespeare came to America as a cultural heritage. He continued as a symbol of excellence, powerfully worked upon the American creative imagination. The American adventure and the Shakespearean adventure become a sprightly and a spacious episode in the chronicle of that larger achievement, which is the human adventure.
This place may well be New York, Baltimore, Philadelphia, Charleston, or, a bit more soberly, even Boston. The scene is the theater of the immediate post-revolutionary years. From the orchestra, a familiar 18th century air. The house is lighted by the shimmers to the light of candles reflected by glass chandeliers. From the boxes, the wealthy and cultivated smile down upon the stage. From the dress circle, stout tradesmen look on, a little uneasy in the presence of Shakespeare. From galleries, the plain American folk await their first view of a performance by a professional cast. Now the play has begun. And from A Midsummer Night's Dream, with its fantasy of ancient Athens, the audience hears...
Oh, teach me how you look, and with what art you sway the motion of Demetrius's heart.
I frown upon him, yet he loves me still.
The more I love, the more he hateth me.
His folly, Helena, is no fault of mine.
None but your beauty. Would that fault were mine.
Take comfort. He no more shall see my face. Lysander and myself will fly this place.
Helen, to you our minds we will unfold tomorrow night, when Phoebe doth behold her silver visage in the watery glass, decking with liquid pearl the bladed grass, a time when lover's flight doth feel concern.
Thus Shakespeare on the eastern seaboard immediately after the Revolution. It is Shakespeare played by British actors for their audience in the British upper-class tradition. Shakespeare played for men and women consciously concerned with wit and fancy, with elaborate language and with classical allusions beyond the range of common learning, outside the vocabulary of the common tongue. Yet even as the Eastern Seaboard continued its attendance upon Shakespearean plays as a conscious expression of somewhat affected learning and interests, the stream of American life, first a trickle, then a freshet, then a roaring river surges inland to the west. Over the Alleghenies, along the paths of the Ohio and the lakes, into the states of the old Northwest Territory, into the wildernesses of Tennessee, Georgia, Mississippi, and Kentucky, a new people, not colonials, but Americans, and a new culture, not English, but American, enters upon the conquest of a continent. And with the pioneers, with the fiddle and the powder horn, with the candle mold and the woodsman's axe, go Shakespeare's lines. Drama all men may understand. Characters all men may hate, fear, admire, and love. Thus, in a log fort in the Cherokee country,
friends, tonight here at the fort, we're mighty honored to have with us a group of traveling play actors. Regular actors, folks. Fresh from the triumphs before the crowned heads of Europe and such places. And by request, appearing before their majesties, the American public.
Get to the point.
Never mind the speech-making, Ed.
Let's have the show.
Well, darn it, I'm getting to the show. Got to be done proper. This here's Shakespeare, ain't it? Preformed, as I was saying, before their majesties, the American citizens. This evening dedicated to Colonel Bowers, the officer commanding this here post, and offered with his compliments before Chief Iron Hatchet of the Cherokee Nation and his party. Well, that's that. Now, gents, friends, citizens, and honored guests, hit her another lick, boys. Here we go. This show is called Macbeth.
Before an audience of woodsmen, soldiers, Indians in a frontier fort, the stage, a rude platform laid upon transport wagons, the lighting, pine torches in the wilderness dusk, the guests, grave Indian faces, ceremonially painted, and by magic, we are upon a heath near Forres, and the play's the thing.
Here I have a pirate's thumb, wrecked as homeward he did come.
Iron Hatchet, chief of the Cherokee, looks on impassively, shrewdly. The scenes change in the half-light of pine torches. The audience is breathless, rapt.
Art thou afeard to be the same in thine own act and valor as thou art in desire? Wouldst live a coward in thine own esteem, letting I dare not wait upon I would, like the poor cat in the adage?
Mean squaw, kill him now, save trouble.
Billy, peace. I dare do all that doth become a man. He dares do more is none.
Him, liar.
The opening movement of a great tragic symphony unfolds on the rude stage. As the white host explains to his Indian guest.
Now, the king is gone to sleep. You see? Macbeth time.
I watch.
Is this a dagger which I see before me? The handle toward my hand? Come, let me touch thee. I have thee not. And yet I see thee still, and on thy blade and dudgeon gouts of blood.
Him got knife.
Thou, poor and firm set earth, hear not my steps. Which way they walk?
Him go in there.
The wolf with healthy pace. I go, and it is done.
Look out. No, him kill king. Jealousy kill him first.
Thus, a performance of Macbeth in the Indian country. Only the quick wit of the pioneers saved the touring British actors from a massacre on the stage. Yet, among the pioneers of every race and calling, let us honor the courage of those British players who brought Shakespeare to a continent. Of the new, the crude, the strange, the stirring America, the dauntless British players themselves have left revealing memoirs. Writes the charming Fanny Kemble of her triumphs in the 1830s.
I remember the cold, dark stages, the blundering, unstudied actors in the supporting roles. I remember my Romeo in Philadelphia, his unfortunate legs most inappropriate for trunk breeches, and enormous feet thrust into a pair of red carpet slippers. But it was delightful when Father and I played together. The pit rose to us like Christians. They shouted and hallooed. They even gave three cheers.
Charles Kean, famous son of his famous father, Edmund Kean,
I played in the West, starring in Richard III. I remember a great lout of a Western fellow was one of my underlings in the play. I was the king, of course. The fellow kept his hat on all the time he was on stage. I drew him aside. Old chap, I said, I think we'd better uncover in this scene. I mean, after all, the subject doesn't keep his hat on. The presence of royalty, you know.
Fiddlesticks, old chap, says he. We have no such respect for kings in this country.
Ellen Tree, speaking of an appearance in Frontier St. Louis somewhat later.
I was Juliet in a town, St. Louis, I believe it was. Anyway, it was on a large river. I was doing the balcony scene from Romeo and Juliet, the music hall. Oh, Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo? Deny thy father, refuse thy name, or if thou wilt not, be but sworn my love, and I'll no longer be a captain.
Yes, of course, Ellen. Romeo answers, shall I hear more, or shall I speak at this?
Oh, Romeo answered all right. But as I looked off stage, behind Romeo, heaven, the wings were afire. It must have been the most impassioned Juliet ever to gesture a lover. My gesture meant not, I love you, but my Romeo, the wings are afire, dearest Romeo. Get a swab to it and stop it, somebody. Run, Romeo, the wings are afire.
I know. Oh, dear. The footlights in the American West are always those cursed candle floats set in a tin cup.
Yes.
I've often seen Hamlet or King Lear or some imposing character grab a swab and douse the flames before making his entrance. That was Grand Fondo. Amazing, the Americans. We never, never knew how they learned Shakespeare.
The touring actor may not have known, but we know. Americans learned Shakespeare from the stage and platform, from the pulpit and in the schoolhouse. Moreover, the full, robust, rhetorical clamor of Elizabethan oratory appealed to the dramatic instincts of the pioneer whose very life was a drama. As an illustrator of fine points of honor and the ideals of conduct, Shakespeare was a powerful moral authority.
You are listening to the story of Shakespeare in America, another chapter from the Notebooks of Scholarship on the Human Adventure.
Shakespeare himself might well have been delighted by the characters who discussed his works in the New West. In a Western drinking saloon, for instance.
Oh, Mac, barkeep, yeah. Two more of the same.
Sure, gents.
Ah, wait up, Ed. Here's Bowleg.
Oh, howdy, Bowleg.
Hi, Bowleg.
Howdy, boys.
Maybe three, bartender.
Three it is.
Yeah, we was talking about Julius Caesar we all seen last night.
Yeah, fine, weren't it? I sure admired to see it. Mighty moving show.
Well, here's your prize, gents. I seen it, too. Especially that fellow Brutus, which was the noblest Roman of them all. All the conspirators, save only him, did what they done in envy of this here now, Caesar.
Now, bartender, that's where you and me differ. You and Tom hold Brutus was a noble Roman, and I take exception. How about you, Bowleg? Yes.
I claim Brutus acted according to his life.
I ain't saying he didn't. Colonel, like him, like he didn't know no better.
Well, now, I like that. Who was living in Rome, Brutus or you?
I claim the whole thing was politics. Here you are,
Jim. Yeah, thank you kindly, Mac. How about you, Bowleg? How do you stand on this here Brutus?
Well, boys, first off, here's good luck.
Well, same thing.
Yeah, happy day.
Now, as to Brutus, it seems to me, gents, Brutus figured this here Caesar was getting too big for his breeches.
That's right. Exactly right, Bowleg.
So Brutus aimed to bust up partnership with him.
Yeah, right again. And how did he bust up the partnership? Did this here noble Roman bust up partnership fair and square? Did he divvy up the horses and the cattle and pay his half of the debts, round up his outfit and clear out of Rome? He did not.
Well, what did you want him to do, sneak out of town like a sick coyote? He had his honor to protect.
That's just what I was waiting to hear. His honor. That's right. His honor. You heard that fella Anthony tell about that, didn't you? Quarant worth a counterfeit peso. And is that what you call honor? Is it? Well, answer me, is it? Hold on now. Hold on yourself.
Now, boys, this here's all just a friendly talk. Don't get riled, neither of you. Fill them up again, Mac.
Sure thing, boy. Lay them all around, Jim.
I'm telling you what Brutus fought. And I'm telling you what he done. He killed Caesar, that's what. And how did he kill him? Did Brutus send word around to Caesar that he was a-gunning for him? Did he pass along a fair warning to watch his step and keep his eye peeled? Did he?
That weren't the custom in them days.
Oh, hang the custom. It's a principle I'm talking about.
I still claim it was politics. Nothing but politics.
Oh, Dad, blame it. Did Brutus down Caesar in a fair fight? Did he? Now, that's a question. And I'll thank you for a civil answer.
But in Rome...
I don't give a darn about Rome. I say Brutus was a low-down, army-sneaking polecat. Busts up a partnership, gets together a passel of renegades, and sneaks up on Caesar unsuspecting, and
now
stabs
that's
him.
That's politics. Pure politics, nothing else. Here you are, Jim.
Oh, boys, you're getting a mite excited.
Yeah, you're an older fella. You be the judge, Bowleg.
Well, boys, looks to me like in this case you got two things. You got ambition, that's Caesar's. And you got character, that's Brutus's.
And what ambition?
And what character?
Fellers, this here play ought to be a lesson, especially to you young men. Cultivate refined friends, worthwhile company, elevating conversation. Hurry up, Mac.
Come on, boy.
Already? Well, here's to you, boys.
Here's you go,
boy. To the bar, gents, remembering the play's the thing.
A barroom discussion of Shakespeare. Well, why not? Shakespeare was played in taverns in Shakespeare's time. He was played in barrooms and billiard parlors and dance halls and makeshift theaters in 100 towns and villages of the rising West. Yet in some towns, the theater was not thought to be a wholesome enterprise. As the famous American actor Joseph Jefferson recalled an incident.
In 1839, I was a boy making a Western tour with my parents. I remember our company manager, very businesslike, talking with a young fellow, very tall. We'd been forbidden to play because some of the reform people brought an injunction against us. I remember the young man and the manager...
You say you'll volunteer your services to give us a hearing without a fee?
I'll be glad to do so, for you and for your company.
Well, how do you propose to go about it?
Oh, I'll speak before the council. Point out play-going never hurt me. Helped me, in fact. Helped me a lot.
Well, do you think it'll work?
Don't know. Folks will have to judge pretty much by me.
Well, now, that's mighty decent of you, Mr. I don't believe I caught the name.
I'm a lawyer here in Springfield. Lincoln's the name, sir. Abraham Lincoln.
Then, in January of 1848, a gleam of gold in the tail race of John Sutter's mill on the American River in California set in motion forces which were to bring American pioneering to a new pitch of the picturesque and the violent. The cry was gold, the rush to California. Young, reckless, 2,000 miles from the restraints of the older communities and conditioned by the vicissitudes and violence of the mines, the 49ers wear life carelessly, take fortune as it comes. In the gold fields, the village virtues of thrift, piety, industry, and mere respectability are soon forgotten. The gold fields themselves are a stage, the miners the makers of their own lines. Life is new, vivid, bold, dramatic.
Hey, step right up, gents. The Palace of Pleasure, Faro, Poker, Roulette, Red Dog, Hazard. No limits and no closing. Try your luck, gents.
Here you are, men. Best prices in the gold field. Shovel, $75. Wash pan, $15. Soap, candles, chewing tobacco, Irish potatoes, $2 an item.
Yowee! 15 pounds of nuggets and a pretty gal on beneath. Champagne for the lady, Curly.
Bubbly water? Oh, you're a darling.
There'll be a swimming in it before the evening's over. Pour it out and keep it coming. What'd you say your name was, sugar?
As Professor Dunn notes,
in California, the moral element which checked theatrical performances in the East simply did not exist. In California, the Shakespearean tradition became the very hallmark of culture. San Francisco's first Jenny Lind Theater was owned by an illiterate ex-cab driver named Tom McGuire, and located over a gambling hall. But the Booths and Chapmans played Hamlet, Macbeth, Othello, Richard III, packing the Jenny Lind to the doors. Here at last, British tradition and American flexibility scored a tremendous success. Here before an audience well used to violence, the jealous passion and poetry of Othello found an unforgettable setting.
Othello?
Aye, Desdemona. Have you prayed tonight?
Aye, my lord.
If you bethink yourself of any crime unreconciled as yet to heaven and grace, solicit for it straight.
Alas, my lord, what do you mean by that?
Well, do it and be brief. I would not kill thy unprepared spirit. I would not kill thy soul.
Why, I should fear I know not, since guiltiness I know not. Yet I feel.
Think on thy sins.
They are loves I bear to you.
Aye, and for that thou diest.
That death's unnatural, the kills for love.
Peace, and be still.
I will so. What's the matter?
That handkerchief which I so loved and gave thee, thou gavest to Cassio.
No. By my life and soul, send for the man and ask him. I never did offend you in my life, never loved Cassio. I never gave him token.
By heaven, I saw my handkerchief in his hand.
He found it then. I never gave it him. Send for him hither. He will not say so.
No. His mouth is stopped. Anastiago hath ta'en order for it.
Oh, my fears interpreted. Is he dead?
Out, trumpet! Weepest thou for him to my face?
Kill me tomorrow. Let me live today.
Nay, if you strive.
But half an hour.
Being done, there is no pause.
But while I say one prayer.
It is too late.
Yes.
My lord. What ho, my lord.
What noise is this? Not dead. Not quite yet dead. I that am cruel am yet merciful. I would not have thee linger in thy pain. No more moving. Still as the grave.
Oh, good, my lord, I would speak a word with you.
I think she stirs again. No. What's best to do? If she come in, she'll sure speak to my wife. My wife. What wife? I have no wife. Oh, insupportable. Oh, heavy hour. Methinks it should be now a huge eclipse of sun and moon, that the affrighted globe should yawn at alteration.
The frenzy of the Moor, the stark and murderous passion of a tale of love and death, saw tragedy restored to its ancient function, purging through pity and terror the minds of the audience entering into a work of art. The California performances of the 1850s marked the complete Shakespearean conquest of the continent. And then in the 1860s, when the real tragedy of the Civil War entered upon the stage of history, when the nation's agony was orchestrated for canon and written in blood once more as in the days of the Revolution, then America turned to Shakespeare, the teacher, the moralist, the understander, the comforter. Again, men turned to Shakespeare as a personal guide, as a wellspring of inspiration, as a source of inner courage and consolation. The prairie lawyer we met in Springfield is 56 now. He is president of the United States. He has met with his generals on a steamer near Grant's City Point headquarters in the spring of 1865. The final victory cannot be long delayed. The war's end cannot be more than a matter of weeks. The day is Sunday, and in the American fashion of reading, that is, speaking aloud from the text, the president muses on a long-remembered passage.
Better be with the dead, whom we to gain our peace have sent to peace.
and on the torture of the mind to lie in restless ecstasy.
Oh, excuse me, Mr. President. I heard your voice. I didn't know you were alone.
That's all right, Mr. Stanton. I've been reading.
Reading? Oh, Shakespeare, I see it is.
Yes. In times like these, the words speak out to me. The line says something that we might all heed. Listen. Better be with the dead whom we, to gain our peace, have sent to peace. And then, Duncan is in his grave. After life's fitful fever, he sleeps well. Reason has done his worst. Nor steel, nor poison, malice domestic, foreign levy. Nothing can touch him further.
Well, Mr. President, Well, it's great poetry, of course, but the grave and all. John Wilkes Booth is playing in Washington, sir.
Oh, is that so?
When we return, I thought perhaps you'd like to have them reserve a box for you and your party.
Here again, your host on The Human Adventure, Mr. Walter Yeust.
In Professor Esther Cloudman Dunn's study of the influence of Shakespeare upon American thought and canons of conduct, we may trace an extraordinarily fruitful interaction between art and life. Through the works of Shakespeare, a playwright of the 16th century speaks to a new nation across 3,000 miles of ocean and across a time passage of 300 years. In the adaptation of Shakespearean acting to American conditions, in the embodiment of his poetry into the very structure of American thought, we are again reminded that artistic excellence is an enduring thing. We are reminded that the arts, no less than the sciences, grow and accrue and evolve out of those achievements of the mind which go to make up the best which is known and thought in the world. Today, as our age seeks new goals in the discoveries of science and new triumphs in the scope and mastery of the arts, let us remember that human accomplishment takes an immense stimulus from the past, only insofar as it uses the legacies of all time to enlarge upon the present, which is in our hands, and to prefigure the future, which others shall take over from us. For that enlargement, that growth, that achievement is learning, and learning is the human adventure.
Your Science Magazine of the Air has brought you another story from The Human Adventure, a broadcast presented for American men and women in the armed forces in every overseas theater of operations. The Armed Forces Radio Service.